and welcome to Objects in This Rearview, the podcast where men talk about the paths our lives have taken and what we hope to see on the road ahead. I am your host, Travis Montez. In this episode, I speak with Greg Vasquez Norman. Greg and I met in 2008 while working at a youth organization in New York City called The Door. I was an attorney addressing family-related issues for our youth members, and Greg was a career and education coach. Since our time as co-workers, Greg has relocated to Ohio, where he's an independently licensed social worker and director of the Foster Youth Mentoring Program at an organization in Cleveland's East Side. He is now also the father of two. A fun fact about Greg is that he also has a career as an amazing DJ, something he has been doing for over 25 years, playing under the moniker DJ No One. He's open for legendary acts like The Roots, Rich Medina, KRS-One, and The Foreign Exchange. He was part of the legendary Fat Beats Records in New York City, where he hosted a Fat Beats Live on EastVillageRadio.com from 2009 to 2010, for you old heads out there. I wanted to talk to Greg on our podcast about many things, but mostly about his career being of service to young people. You may find it interesting to know or surprising to know there aren't many men in our field, and I was interested to get his perspective on his journey as well as his what's next. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. This is Objects in This Rearview.
Gregory Norman, thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, good to be here.
I always just sort of like jumping in with my guests because I find you all fascinating. And sort of where I want to begin with you is what you do for a living, because that's kind of how I met you, is in the world of working with kids. So I want to talk about that a little bit.
All right. Yes, I am a social worker. I'm an independently licensed social worker. And I wound up back in my hometown, Cleveland. I've been back here for 8 years. And I run a mentoring program for young people that are in foster care. It's a grant-funded program. And so, yeah, this agency that I've been with for 8 years hired me to run one of their residential treatment units, which was super intense and was awesome at times, and then sort of took over my life. And yeah, I mean, there's been a big movement for years in social work about taking care of yourself. I feel like that's a thing now just in general, but in the field of social work, you know, this idea that like you just can't help anybody else out if you're not, you know, doing your self-care is a thing. And so I became aware of the fact that that was way out of balance. But yeah, this program is a good fit for me. So that's what I'm currently doing.
I've spent 20 years working with kids in the juvenile justice and foster care system. So I'm very excited to have someone who's also in this world to interview. Yes. I guess sort of my first question is like, what does mentoring kids in foster care entail? What does that look like?
If you're familiar with Big Brothers, Big Sisters, I mean, that's a very well-known national mentoring model, 150 years old. And so it's really friendship. It's really spending, you know, time, one-on-one time in the community, a couple times a month with the young person that's in care. And we follow all the same standards of practice nationally that Big Brothers, Big Sisters does, but we are not technically considered an official chapter because we're grant-funded and we serve a very specific population. There, of course, is a general, you know, Cleveland chapter of Big Brothers Big Sisters, and the organization I work for is an old Jewish organization that has for over 100 years had an official Big Brothers Big Sisters chapter for Jewish. We also license foster parents and place young people in our foster homes. And so when this grant became available, was it 8 years ago, whatever, 7 years ago, we applied for it based on our expertise, you know, with running the Jewish Big Brother Big Sister chapter and with operating foster homes, kind of married the two. And
what's the importance, or I guess why do kids in foster care need mentors as opposed to kids generally?
This is not all young people in permanent custody of Cuyahoga County, which is the county, you know, Cleveland is a part of in Northeast Ohio. These are young people that are in permanent custody, so they've exhausted all opportunity, possibility that they will return to biological parents, or possibility that there will be a kinship placement.
So these are kids with basically no family, like no one's come stepping up to the plate to take them, or no one's available.
Yeah, no one that can really take care of them, who either can or is willing to, you know, whatever, you know, they go through a whole process in the courts where it's like, you know, at some point they have to be like, okay, this isn't happening. This kid needs permanency. So now the county's going to have to like take responsibility for making this happen.
And we're talking about teenagers.
Adoption. I mean, for our program, these kids can be as young as like 10 years old, as old as 20. Mm-hmm. They emancipate at 21 here. So yeah, the biggest thing that mentoring does for young people in foster care is it offsets all of the transition, the changes in foster placements and schools and, you know, peer groups, all that, and gives them, you know, ideally a caring, consistent adult in their life that will make time for them at least twice a month, you know, to spend time with them sort of no matter what their level of care is, no matter where they're placed, et cetera. So that there is, yeah, a familiar face and somebody checking for them, et cetera. cetera, like kind of no matter what, you know? So yeah, but ideally it becomes a part of their safety net, you know, as they grow and mature and, you know, develop and emancipate, all that.
What do you love most about working with kids in foster care?
You know, I think that I love working with young people just sort of in general, especially like teenagers and young adults, and that whole process of being an adolescent and figuring out who you are, what you're all about, and discarding things that, you know, were kind of given to you and just making sense of it. I've always found that super interesting. You know, a big thing for me is music, has always been music. And I found like my passion for music when I was a teenager myself. So some of it is about making that connection, you know, asking young people what they're listening to and genuinely being interested in them. So I think that, you know, I'm compelled by young people that are in foster care just because they're, you know, a huge need, a need that I don't know if it is the most in need population, but, you know, it's got to be up there. And so I think that it's a group of young people that are definitely worthy of whatever talents I have to give, energy I have to give, et cetera. And so I think that that's part of, you know, why I've wound up for so many years, much of my career working with young people that are in foster care. You know, it's a very, very good use of my time, you know.
So full disclosure, how I met Greg was working at a youth organization called The Door, where we worked with young people. I worked with young people in a legal capacity, providing family law, foster care, family court, legal representation from kids 12 to 21. And Greg was the most popular staff member with staff and kids.
You this really, isn't true, but thank you.
I'm not a liar, guys. And I don't give compliments easily. So I think you all know who to believe. I think, not everyone is equipped to work with kids. Not everyone has the skills to connect with kids. And you always impressed me as someone who, like, that seemed like a natural fit. You seem to have credibility with young people. And I think that's, like, the most important thing, because young people have a really sensitive bullshit meter. And I feel like you cared and you enjoyed it. And I think that's also, like, you never... Even though, you know, there were wild times at the door and kids came with all kinds of things to us, you never seemed overwhelmed or burdened by it. And I think young people in the situations that we found them in really respected and appreciated when they weren't made to feel like burdens. And so...
Yeah,
so I don't want to talk about like what inspired you, how you got into like social work and then working with young people. So you grew up in Cleveland, but you didn't go to college in Cleveland.
I went to Kent State, which is like an hour east of Cleveland, you know, Kent State University. Yeah. So when I was at Kent, like I said, as a teenager, I found, you know, music for myself and hip hop in particular. And at that time, you know, in the early 90s, it was cool.
The best time.
Yeah. It was cool to be conscious and to be political and to be, you know, care about your health and your community and understand your history and all those things that really opened my eyes to the world, you know? And so, that was so compelling to me that, you know, it became my thing. I was a three sport athlete growing up. And so at a point in high school, I mean, you had
to really nice way of saying jock. That's what we called them.
Yes. Facts. So, and at a point in high school, I wasn't that interested in kind of going to the next level and, you know, seeing if I could play in college, whatever. And at the same time, this music was really resonating with me. And that's sort of when the passion kind of switched from being all about sports to being all about music. And when I got to Kent State, a friend of mine got a show on college radio and let me know about it and was like, hey, you can get a show. You don't have to have any experience. You can play whatever you want. And so that's what I did, became, you know, my thing. I interned with him. Then I got my own show and then I wound up becoming urban music director at WKSR at Kent State, and have been a DJ ever since. I actually wound up studying radio because that experience was so powerful. I'm like, oh, I could do this for a living. Not really realizing that like corporate radio was going to be completely different than, you know, college radio. And so, you know, like, shame on Kent for not advising me.
What do you think the difference between college radio and corporate radio is?
Just that, you know, especially at that time. So, you know, corporate radio was deregulated in 96, and that's what allowed, you know, just a few organizations to buy up all these different stations around the country and really streamline everything so that it's like, you know, to where it is now, to where it's like, you know, the black station is the same in every single market. You know, it's not
you only
specific
get the same
to that
music.
Particular. Yeah, exactly. So it really, really changed it. In all fairness to myself, I was like right there, right when it happened. I'm like studying it as it changed and evolved like that. that. So yeah, I mean, you know, corporate radio does not really care much about content. It's like whatever people will buy, you know, commercial time doing, as long as they can sell their ads, they don't care what the content is. You know, people will settle for 10 songs. They'll get 10 songs, you know, the same 10 songs. So at any rate, I did that for a couple of years. And then I was realizing I was getting quickly separated from my passion. I'm like, you know, I got into this because I'm so into music, but I'm wasting it. I'm pushing buttons and, you know, like monitoring a mixing board and producing shows I could care less about. And so I'm like, you know, what can I didn't need to revisit this and get back to what I'm passionate about. And that's when, again, you know, I kept this like focus on kind of social justice and things like that throughout my adolescence. And I'm like, you know, I think that the thing to do is to, you know, try to help young people that are having a tough time in terms of their situation or their mental health or whatever. And I've got, you know, music kind of going for me as a way to build rapport and make connections with youth. And so I wound up moving to Columbus my girlfriend at the time. She was finishing her undergraduate degree at Ohio State. And so I moved to Columbus with her and got my first job. And it was in a transitional living program at Huckleberry House in Columbus.
And for people who don't know what transitional living is, explain that.
You know, when it becomes clear, and these are typically young people that are in foster care, when it becomes clear that, you know, like you're a little too old to be placed in somebody else's home, not old enough to really and truly be out on your own, then, you know, there are transitional living programs that help you build your independent living skills. Usually these are scattered site, you know, apartments that, you know, for the most part, there is no adult on site, you know.
So like a little transition between like all the support that foster care is supposed to provide and then being totally on your own and teaching you all the shit that like you don't like how to cook for yourself, kind of how to pay bills, how to
all of
a
it.
Bank account.
How to stay out of the bullshit, all of it. Yeah, pick your battles and like, yeah, for sure. So yeah, it's like, you know, so I'm running around Columbus, you know, meeting up with all these young people in their apartments and trying to teach them independent living skills and whatever. And I was pretty into it. So yeah, so that was like, to me, that was it. And I continued to DJ. And I was, like I said, I was really able to make use of my passion through that. And so that's kind of how I started in social work was at that point, you know.
How did you get to New York where I met you?
Oh, so this is... All right. So I did, I was in Columbus, you know, working with young people in this transitional living program for a couple of years. And then I returned home because, you know, my girlfriend at the time, her grandmother was ill. And so we came home to try to help her take care of her grandmother. She was in my ear about, you know, there was some narrative about how I wasn't truly like utilizing my, you know, potential and whatever, all these very healthy things that young adults tell each other in relationships.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you received it all perfectly well at the time. You were like, that's
great. Yeah.
You were like, that's a great idea.
Yeah. Let me try to like live up to your expectation of me. My father was an attorney. And so I was like, what if I take social work and, you know, and I give it a go trying to be a, you know, try to get into law school and try to be a public interest attorney. And so at the time, you know, CUNY had what seemed to be like the best, you know, program that was prepared people to go into that particular kind of law. And so I took the LSAT a couple of times and got into a couple of really terrible schools. I was not a, you know, like most social workers, I'm not a great standardized test taker. And my mind doesn't work particularly well in that way that the LSAT measures. And so yeah, I got waitlisted 2 years in a row to go to law school at CUNY and never got in. And I'm like, you know, I'm not going to force this thing to happen. If, you know, I'm going to law school is not it, then I'll go for my master's in social work. And
you're so lucky you didn't get into law school.
Yeah, thank you.
It's a Ponzi scheme. Don't do it. That's my advice.
Right. Exactly. Well, then I wind up going to Columbia. So the debt was there. Don't you worry.
Oh, you ponzed it anyway. So then you come to New York and end up working with kids.
Correct.
Does that happen right away? Or
so I'll say that I had some success, you know, with my music career DJing in Cleveland. But what I was really into was some pretty underground independent hip hop. And there wasn't a huge, you know, market for it here. And so I always wondered in a larger market, would I have more success? And I always dreamt of, you know, living in New York City. And so when I was looking at different schools for social work, my old family friend, good friend of my mom's that she grew up with, got her PhD from Columbia's social work school. And she was like, oh, you have to go to Columbia. It's the first social work school. It's the best social work school. But I'm a public school kid. I never went to private school a day in my life. And so the idea of going to an Ivy League school is like, are you serious? Like, I have no frame of reference for that. You know, she was like, well, you should at least apply and just see. And you can kind of go from there. And so I applied. They had me come out and interview, actually. They didn't accept me straight away. I was a pretty good student in undergrad, but, you know, but even still, Kent is not considered, or at least at that time, was not considered a very rigorous school. So I think they had some reservations, but at any rate, they wound up admitting me. And so I'm like, this is my chance to get to New York. And that girl that I had moved back to Cleveland and helped take care of her grandmother, I wound up marrying her. We were just freshly divorced at this time in 06. And so I'm like, you know what? I'm going to New York, you know, to finish my education and, you know, and DJ and just and experience it, you know, kind of live my dream. I think because of my connection to hip hop too, and that hip hop is a manifestation of the young people, you know, black and brown kids and young adults from New York City. I always felt compelled to give something back. I mean, it was something that changed my life so profoundly that I'm like, you know, the idea that I would go and kind of make a contribution, give back in some way, or just be a part of it. All those things was, you know, very intriguing to me. So.
I want to talk about music specifically in just a second, but I want to ask you one more question about sort of like your path in social work. In my job, I've worked with social workers for 20 years now. I've probably worked with like 100 or so social workers, and two of them have been men. What do you think being a man in like the social work field, particularly one working with the youth population that you work with, how do you think that impacts your work, I guess is the question.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting thing because, you know, with your coworkers, I mean, as you said, it's almost all women. And so being social, being colleagues with women is different than men for sure. So you kind of have to be mindful of some of the power dynamics, et cetera. And then even with, you know, with children and young adults and whatever, there's still, you know, definitely a significant stigma around men who would choose to be in the helping professions, you know, like you must be up to something. You must be like grooming kids and not actually want to just be a clinician or run programs or whatever that benefit children. Like, why would you do that? Why would you agree to be underpaid and, you know,
and do women's work is how I've often heard it like called. Oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah. So,
which is weird.
Yeah. But I mean, yeah, but it's, you know, but it's a unique thing. And I think that really appeals to me, you know, that I am somewhat of a novelty or, you know what I mean? There aren't a lot of me around. And so for places where it's like, you know, for all the, you know, like the parents that wanted their boy to work with a male clinician or, you know, et cetera, it's like, you know, you provide a great service.
It's the same for my job as a lawyer for children. Most lawyers for children, I think at my office now, there may be three of us out of 50 attorneys who are, or maybe five, and that's like a record number of us who are men. You know, I started this when I was 25, and certainly I think for my clients and their families, there was a little bit of suspicion for sure, but also like an appreciation to have like a man in that space who like cared and who like was consistent. I think there was also, as much as like there was like a pushback and a suspicion, my feedback from my clients over the years has been like, one of the most meaningful parts of my job has been sort of like what it means to them to have a man to occupy that space, particularly when they've had so many bad relationships with men or like not consistent ones or like not a lot of people in power positions who are willing to like understand from a male perspective their lives. They found it, I think there was overall from my clients a very much an appreciation to have like a man in that space for them. Because they're not a lot of us. And I think there was something about like, oh, men can care. Men can fight for me. Men can use their skills to help me. I think they appreciated that in a way, long term. It took me a long time to realize, because teenagers aren't the best about being thankful verbally. But I've been in it long enough where like I've been able to like see clients through many phases of their lives. Where they've been able to express that.
Yes. And there's this, you know, as I, you know, my program now, my mentoring program is powered by volunteers. And so a lot of my job is being in the community and trying to recruit, you know, volunteers. And it's very hard to get men to volunteer, you know, to step up.
What do you think that is?
And be mentors. It's all, you know, shades of the exact same thing. It's like, you know, it's another, you know, selfless kind of a thing that, you know, women are typically much more, you know, step up to and will follow through on. So it's very hard. I've tried really, really hard to attract, you know, men to the volunteer opportunity and make it, you know, like even our, I don't know how familiar you are with our brand and our logo, but it's masculine looking. It's, you know, it doesn't look like something that is targeted at women. It's targeted more at young men, you know, like younger men. Like men in their 30s, or you know what I mean?
I also wonder if part of the issue is like men don't necessarily perceive themselves as having something to offer in that capacity.
Maybe. Usually what they say to me is, I don't feel like I've got it. I don't feel stable enough myself to give something back.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like, yeah. I always tell folks, I mean, say, you don't have to have it. None of us have it all figured out. But, you know, what you have is, seriously, it's like, but if you will show up for this young person, that's all you have to do. Like, show up, be honest. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's what they need. They don't need you to pretend. They need what you bring.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's a powerful thing. You know, if they can see you trying to figure some stuff out, but still being there for all of it, you know?
Yeah, I can tell you as a 25-year-old lawyer, I did not have it all together. And so it was amazing. Right. And some of my clients were like 4 years younger than me. And so like I was like, you're about to be on your own. I don't even feel like I'm on my own right now.
I'm supposed to advise you about this?
20 years later, still don't really feel like I have it all together. So now I want to talk about my second favorite thing about you, which is your DJing. So at the door, we have these, was it a holiday party or like a staff talent night?
I think it was a staff talent night that you're referring to.
Yeah, and I was reading poetry, and to this day,
eyes, right?
Yeah, you gave me the best musical intro that I've ever had at a reading. Your DJ name is DJ No One, right?
Yes.
And so I think there are various periods that I love around hip hop and black music. The 1988, I think, was a great year of music. I think 90s was the greatest time. There was like a couple of years in the early 2000s that I also really fuck with, like 2000 to 2006. But like, I love you are like an amazing DJ. And I say that for two reasons. One, I think people miss the artistry that is involved in DJing, that it's not just sort of like making a playlist. That like, there is really a breadth of knowledge and like connection that has to happen to like know music and string music together and create an atmosphere that I think you really epitomize to me. So I really want to talk about like how you got into music, some of your favorite music, and also again, talk more explicitly about like how and specifically about how like that love has helped you foster really great relationships with youth over your career. Mm-hmm. So we'll start with like how you, I don't want to like steal the question, like when did you fall in love with hip hop? But that's essentially what I'm asking without asking it that way.
Sort of, right, yeah. All right, so, wow, where do we start? All right, so, you know, I'm the youngest of five. You're also the youngest, correct?
What?
Is that accurate?
I'm the youngest?
You're also the youngest, right?
Did you guess that or have I told you that?
No, I think I know that. You either told me it or something or other. Maybe you mentioned a previous episode.
I was like, am I giving youngest vibes on this, Joe? I am my mom's youngest child.
Okay. So at any rate, so I'm the youngest
and
of
her
my,
favorite.
Of course. Youngest of five, my two parents, and they split when I was pretty young. So it wasn't great. I came into a situation I think that was pretty volatile. And I think I was wired to be sort of angry to begin with. And as like they're divorcing or whatever, my sort of anger becomes like more palatable. And they were trying to figure out, you know, help me find coping strategies. I think it was my mom's idea. I'm not 100% sure. Somebody thought, why don't we get him a drum. Maybe he, you know, I rocked to soothe myself as a child. So like something about rhythm always kind of like soothed me. And he gave me a drum for my birthday, a snare drum. And I set it up next to my brother had this giant metal desk. And so I would drum on the drum and the desk and like, you know, and just like percussion. It was always something that I was really into. And then like, I was exposed to, you know, some hip hop, you know, at a very young age. I was talking to my wife in the car driving out to our in-laws yesterday about Santa's Rap. Treacherous Three, that's like the first, you know, from Beat Street. Oh, that's like the first rhyme that I memorized. And my friends had seen Beat Street. And so that was something that made its way out to Cleveland. And so we're aware of that. And then I think the biggest thing was that I went to a summer camp in 1985 when I was 10 years old. And one of the counselors, LL, had just put out his first album, Radio. And this one counselor, a young black man, knew all the lyrics and he was very charismatic. And I was just like fascinated by that, you know? And so when I came home, I went to the local record store and like, I need this tape, you know, cassette at the time, right? LL Cool J Radio.
Remember record stores?
Stock. Oh, yeah. They've made a big comeback, actually. But at any rate, so yeah, they ordered the tape and got the tape and, you know, it was on from there. The year after that, Raising Hell Run DMC came out, which was like a kind of a crossover success, you know, with the Aerosmith record, Walk This Way and all that. It's been kind of hip hop ever since. I went through a metal phase in middle school. I was really into Metallica and Slayer and Anthrax and all that stuff. So, but again, very rhythmic, kind of like angry, edgy music. It's similar in a lot of ways, you know. Came right back to hip hop when De La released Three Feet High and Rising. That brought me back to hip hop in a major way.
And so when you got into radio and then got out of radio, when you got into it, what did you sort of imagine a career would be like? Was there a particular kind? Was there even sort of like a DJ that existed at the time that you're like, I want to do with that person. I want to like break this kind of music. I want to be this kind of personality. Did you have like an idea, or you just sort of, it was just so fresh, you knew you were just learning it?
Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the biggest things that I looked to when I was a kid in undergrad, I became familiar with a friend of mine. Mother lived uptown in New York. And so he hit me to Stretch and Bobbito. You know, and so Stretch and Bobbito, for folks that might not be familiar, I don't even know if you're familiar, Travis, but was, you know, is considered like the greatest, you know, college radio show of all time, and out of Columbia, ironically. So yeah, in the early 90s and even through like to the end of the 90s, you know, they had this platform for breaking new artists and just playing all this amazing independent and underground hip hop and major label stuff too. But I think as they started to, in the later 90s, they started doing a show not only on Columbia's frequency, but also on Hot 97. And so I sort of saw that as like, oh, could you bring like good music like to the mainstream, like, you know, to corporate radio? Is that actually a possibility? And so I think that was like the ideal. But I mean, like, that's such an anomaly. Like what they did was because they are who they are. You know what I mean? The timing of it and everything else. But I think that's what I was hoping for in an ideal sense, you know?
I don't think I realized how similar you and I were. So I got into the music industry in high school. I grew up in Nashville. They have record labels there. And I began interning at record labels my junior year of high school. Mostly like country and Christian music, but just sort of like to learn the industry. So like at Warner Brothers, Sony, got a really great experience of like the inside of the music industry. And I came to New York with the idea of being a music journalist. I wanted to be an entertainment journalist. I thought of myself as like,
the Source.
So like those early, like The Source, Vibe magazine, like those, like my dream was to like do what Kevin Powell was doing when like that Tupac interview from when he was in prison. And I came to New York with that plan for myself of like those early, when sort of like urban media was still like fresh and new. So everything was breaking. And like, you really got to like talk to artists and like do these really interesting things. And it was also this moment where like Black music became really popular. So we, you know, I grew up in a time where MTV didn't play Black music. You had BET that played everything. So like on one countdown, you would have rap, you would have Anita Baker, you would have like all Patti LaBelle, all in like one television show. And that really sort of interested me. But by the time I got to journalism school, I think to call it corporate, it's probably pretty accurate. We're like, you know, there was this moment where like everything was coming together, but then also separated, in that kind of journalism that like I like Dream Hampton, like all of those things that were like happening while I was in college started to become harder and harder to happen. And then I was like, what do I do with myself? And I sort of went to law school to like get a few more years before I had to go into the real world and figure out what to do with myself. But I was very much interested in like youth culture, writing about young people's experience. I was an Africana studies major on top of a journalism major. All of my papers in every class had to do with like the death of Tupac, because he died my freshman year, and like the meaning of that to young people. I did a whole hip hop conference at NYU just because that's what I loved. And in law school, the only sort of connection that I found between like really loving Black youth culture and law was juvenile rights. And I didn't even know that that was an area of law. I just sort of like happened upon a class. And I was like, wait, there are lawyers who like do this thing. And when I get to work with like these kids, which was really a privilege to me, they're the best part of this job. Sort of like these kids surviving. And probably my own childhood, they resonated. My childhood wasn't the easiest. And I think also being the adult who got to be an advocate for kids like that in a way that I didn't feel like people advocated for me. You know, I felt like that sort of drew me in, but it was that love of youth creativity that still probably like a healthy disrespect of of adults that I still kind of have that really like made me want to work with. But it was like that I tell people, you know, I'm from a place in time that doesn't exist anymore, because there was this, like this magic time between the 80s and 2000s that was really unifying in a way that I think we don't respect or like acknowledge all the time. So a lot of what you said resonates with me. But you like really got in, like did some really cool stuff with music once you got here, right? Like with Fat Beats and all of that.
So towards the end of my time in Cleveland, I was running around with a collective called Nappy Head Entertainment that was like the longest running like hip hop showcase in Cleveland. And we managed to bring towards the end of my time here, like in 06, we managed to host a couple of shows, and one of which was Slum Village. So Jay Dilla had just died. And so I made a tribute mix to him. We hosted Slum Village. Then a short time after that, we boot camp Click out of Brooklyn. They released another compilation album. And so I made another mix, you know, because we were bringing them to town to like promote that show or whatever. And so these were relatively fresh. And so when I got there, so when I got to New York, I went to Fat Beats and I was like, you know, you guys interested in putting these, you know, on consignment? And they accepted them. And that Dilla mixtape did really, really well. It was like the best selling thing for a while, like in the fall of 2006. And every time I would call the store, like every week, and they'd be like, well, they're sold out, bring down more, you know? And that was like,
I really don't feel like people can understand like how dope mixtapes were.
Oh man. Yeah. To your point about like really telling a story and, you know, having it be something that like kind of makes sense. And yeah. And there's like real mixing, cutting, scratching, everything's like very intentionally done. And yep. So at any rate, so I had some success there and started doing things that I was like, I was just interning at Fat Beats, you know, but selling my mixtapes there. And then there became an opportunity for me to, they had an internet radio show, East Village Radio, EVR, and that recorded, you know, down on the Lower East Side, and became an opportunity for me to be one of the hosts there. And so that was amazing, you know, gave me an opportunity to interview some of the artists that I you know, we're putting out independent hip hop, and we're affiliated with Fat Beats and things like that. So that was a, you know, a dream come true as well, you know, and just doing shows with all the other Fat Beats DJs and opening for DJ Premier and a bunch of other people. Yes, go ahead.
What do you think makes you what do you think makes you different as a DJ, right? Like, what do you think you're what is particularly talented about you as a DJ? I love asking humble people questions like that.
Yes. I think just my ear, you know what I mean? That there are certain connections between music, different, you know, songs, artists, genres, whatever that may not occur to some people. And some of the stuff has become, you know, a lot easier to do over time as technology is, you know, has advanced and things like that. I mean, now with, you know, Serato, it will tell you the BPMs and the key that everything is in. So it's like you can cheat, and that's like, it'll, you know, it'll even sync it up for you so that it's the same tempo and in the same key and, you know, et cetera. But, you know, just recognizing like the vibe of the music, or just it could be some nuance that connects one thing to another. And so I guess that, you know what I mean?
And what keeps you DJing after all this time?
Insecurity? No, I think I just still love the music. You know what I mean? There's still music that I'm discovering that's new, music that's old. And so I've always, you know, kind of made it my business to try to spread the word about good stuff, you know, things, music, artists and things like that may not have the platform or the push, you know, behind them. I feel like that's my, you know, I see myself as a tastemaker of sorts, and it's kind of my job to, you know, find other people that are into music that might think that there is not, you know, either good music that's still coming out, or that they've heard it all and, you know, they feel stuck with just 90s hip hop and there's no other good music that.
So my next question was, do you DJ for your kids?
Do I DJ for them? Yes. I've played their little school functions and put together playlists that my wife has then taken to like little, you know, their little parties at school and stuff like that.
During the pandemic,
I mean, well, I try. Yeah. Yeah. During the pandemic, it's like you had to find all kinds of, you know, ways to entertain yourself. So it's like you turn on all your DJ equipment, hand your, you know, 6-year-old a mic. I mean, that's hours of fun. You know what I mean? It gets annoying after a while, but, you know, like it's. They love it, you know, it's great.
What's some music you've introduced them to that they really like that you're like, yes, I've done it right?
Hot music, Soho, you know, like classic house music like that. Yeah, I mean, they, you know, they feed off of your energy. So it's like they could tell you're really into it. And that's infectious, you know?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of moments, you know, that are connected to music. And, you know, my son's name is Victor Fela. So, you know, Victor for Victor Vaughn, you know, MF Doom, Victor Vaughn, and Fela needs no explanation. So it's a very music heavy naming with that kid, you know, and he's into really pop music too, but he's also into good stuff, you know.
So. Good job, Dad.
Thanks. Try it.
So I guess what I want to talk about next is like, where do you want to go Or what do you see in the future for you both in terms of like your social work and your DJing and your music?
I think in terms of like my career, I'm in a pretty good spot. You know, this is one of the things I like about this current position that I'm in is that I've been able to use my experience throwing, you know, shows for years and years, promoting shows, creating a brand, attracting people to like, you know, a thing, to recruit mentors, you know, something I'm familiar with. So I'm able to kind of use like that skill set and then my, you know, my clinical skills, my ability to connect with young people that are in foster care, kind of put it all together. So I really like it. You know, there's like a lot of variety to it. It's a small program. So I'm not only like overseeing the program, but I'm also like doing a lot of the work myself. So that's, I think that's a good balance for me as well. So I'm in a good spot. I also like the leadership of my organization. I kind of like the direction that they're going in. I think for a long time, I you know, was trying to get to this place where, you know, I need to, you know, open up my own youth center. And my time at the door, our time at the door was magical. It really was. I mean, there were so many talented people there, the overwhelming majority of which were artists on some level. And so like that creative energy, I mean, I've sort of always held that out to be something I would love to try to create myself. But, you know, I'm somebody I don't see myself as being much of like an entrepreneur or, you know, like a lone wolf, you know, strike out on your own kind of a person. So it's tough because I've been always looking for like somebody to partner with or, you know, to kind of like flesh out some of these ideas or start some of these things with. And I'm not 100% sure that's going to happen, but I continue, you know, talking to people and look for things and look for opportunities or whatever. But yeah, I'm in a pretty good spot, I feel like. You know, with running my program. And then as far as DJing goes, I think I'm just trying to get back to what I love the most, which is not playing live for people. Cause you know, I wind up doing like corporate gigs and like, you know, weddings and all kinds of stuff. And a lot of those they're not that much fun artistically. They're not challenging artistically. You know what I mean? So I want to really just get back to focusing on, you know, kind of where it started, making mixes where it's just me and the music in a room, recording myself, putting it out, sending it to people, you know, that I know are into good music and connecting, you know, because that's the biggest thing. It's like the connection, you know, that you make with people through music. So
here's a question that I haven't asked someone that I think you're the perfect person to ask, given the length of time that you've worked with young people. What is it that you think people get wrong about the youth that you work with?
Young people that are in foster care in particular?
Mm-hmm. Either the youth or the system.
What do people get wrong? I think that the first thing that comes to mind is just that you know, people are intimidated or even, you know, scared of our young people. Think that they're like more dangerous than they actually are. And so, you know, shy away from, especially for my program, the idea that I would spend one-on-one time in the community, you know, with this kid that's, you know, that's in foster care, not realizing that, you know, I mean, obviously if we set you up to be assaulted by some kid or deal with some like ridiculous crisis or whatever, it's not real good for business. I mean, those people are not going to come out for a volunteer opportunity like that. So.
Oh, I guess I should ask you this too, since I asked you like, what made you such a great DJ? What makes you such a great social worker and advocate for young people? I have my own ideas, but I want to hear from you. Like, what do you think?
Thank you. Yeah.
Makes you successful at your job.
I think that really just the genuine interest in what they're all about. You know, I think there's a lot of people that, again, find adolescence to be kind of scary, either because of their own experience going through adolescence or just in general, just find that group to be, you know, they don't want to be around them or, you know, don't want to try to engage those young people. And so I think that genuine interest I have in, you know, what they're all about, what they're listening to, why they dress the way they dress, you know, et cetera. What's resonating for them? What's working for them? Or what are they struggling with? All that, being genuinely curious and interested in it. And, you know, coming from not as a voyeur, but, you know, somebody who like, I'd like to try to be helpful in some way, you know, stay in my lane, but be helpful in some kind of a way. So I think that's the biggest thing is like that genuine, like, you know, curiosity and interest in what they're all about, you know, and why, you know.
And because your connection with them happens a lot around music, how much of it is them trying to convince you to listen to their music and that their music is better than yours, the music you grew up with?
Yeah. I don't really debate them. I really try to keep it about them, you know? And the other thing that's tricky for me is like, I remember even going back to the door is that, you know, I don't usually share a lot about, if anything, about my life as a DJ because I feel like it's somewhat of a conflict of interest. Like, I don't want you to be my fan. It's not about me. You know what I mean? It's just about the fact that I'm really into music. And when I was about your age, that's when I really started hearing music and it became so powerful to me. But it's not about, you know, oh, DJ no one, like, you know, like, it's not about that, you know? So I really keep it about them and try to see, you know, like try to hear it the way that they hear it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that would work. I've never asked you this question. I could talk to you about music all day, but I'm going to limit myself to one question.
Okay.
5 favorite albums of DJ No One. 5. And I didn't even say hip hop, but 5 favorite albums. Right.
This is so hard.
Understand this is how I'm going to be spending the rest of my weekend. So pick well.
Okay, good. I would say Nas-O-Matic is one that comes to mind for sure. Reese, How I Do. What else? Estero's first album, Moment of Truth, Gangstar. Is that 4? Yeah. Man, there's so many.
You have one more. It's such that who knew that would be the hardest question I asked you during this interview?
I'll go with What's the 401. That's kind of a generic answer, but
that's a great answer.
It is.
It's a good answer. That's a solid answer.
There should have been more old records. There should have been more source material. There should have been more like 70s, you know, like original breaks, things like that.
Overthinker to the very end.
There you go.
Well, thank you for doing this. I really appreciate it. I find you fascinating. I definitely think the kids at the door were lucky to have you for the time that you were there. And I'm sure the kids that you work with now are super lucky to have you. I just think people who genuinely care about young people and also have the goods to help them in a meaningful way are rare. So I consider you a rarity, my friends.
Thank you so much.
I like to end these interviews with the same question. So, Greg Norman, what's in your rear view?
I would say what's in my rear view is just this idea that, you know, what I'm currently doing is not enough, that I'm not like utilizing what I have to give, you know, utilizing my talents to the most, and just, you know, letting go of that sort of like, you know, negativity and self-doubt and things like that. And realizing that kind of where I am and what I'm doing, it really is enough, you know, not that I shouldn't continue like learning and things like that, but it really is enough.
A great thing to be getting past. Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to this episode of Object in This Rearview. I'm your host, Travis Montez. Remember, the only reason to look back is to see how far we've come.